You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Good day, Mr. Kubrick. My name is Brian Attien. I am a 20-year-old from the Theater Center of the Juilliard School, perhaps the finest acting institution in the world. I say that not as a statement of conceit, but humbly as a simple fact. You will view many different faces, see many people, some faces more attractive than mine, others not quite as attractive. You will find in me the finest actor in the lot, the most beautifully trained, the most capable. I like to think of myself as a young Alec Guinness.
This is Brian Attien, and this clip made him a viral YouTube star overnight. It's a vintage self-taped audition for director Stanley Kubrick's 1987 war drama, Full Metal Jacket. Like countless male actors his age, the word that Kubrick was assembling a new film about young men at war, after being away from the screen for 7 years no less, was enough to send Attien into a frothed-mouth frenzy, throwing caution, restraint, and good taste to the wind in a bid to win a coveted spot in Kubrick's cast.
I ain't gonna walk again. Not even on crutches. A doctor says I broke my back. You wanna know something? You wanna know something?
This collective, self-taped hysteria for a prestigious director's new war film was surpassed only by the hysteria that accompanied Terrence Malick's decision to make The Thin Red Line after a 20-year absence from cinema screens. Nevertheless, Attien's unbelievable audition video reveals two very important things about Kubrick as an artist. The first is that he was one of the first directors to have a rabid fan base. The second is that said fan base could never quite pin down Kubrick's artistic intentions, or predict how he would approach a given subject. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see that Attien's choice to perform a melodramatic soliloquy from Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders was a catastrophically poor one given the grim, cynical tone of Kubrick's finished product. Attien couldn't possibly have known this, however. We easily forget that up until the late 60s and early 70s, war films were lush, glossy epics featuring romantic, idealistic leads fighting for truth and good. Modern war films portray war as the living hell on earth that it actually is, and Full Metal Jacket's unflinching vision of combat's toll on the human psyche can be credited as a crucial turning point in the genre. The experience of the Vietnam War had soured America on the prospect of warfare, mostly because the widespread adoption of television allowed the war to be broadcast into the homes of every family, punctuating their supper with gunfire, explosions, and the anguished cries of wounded men. Kubrick felt a desire to make a war film that reflected this new paradigm, and selected author Gustav Hasford's 1979 novel, The Short Timers, as the source material upon which he had based the story for what would eventually become Full Metal Jacket. Working once again with his brother-in-law and producing partner Jan Harlan, Kubrick recruited a novelist and Vietnam veteran named Michael Herr to help him craft the script. The shoot audaciously faked rural England for the humid jungles of Vietnam, with the production timetable ballooning longer than a standard tour of duty. Where most actors and craftsmen would quit in anger over the prolonged schedule, this element of Kubrick's shooting style had become so well known by this point that his collaborators willingly signed on, knowing full well it would inevitably happen. They placed their utmost faith and confidence in Kubrick, and that trust and passion showed through in the final product. Full Metal Jacket may be a flawed, uneven film, but that can't stop it from enduring as one of the defining films in the war genre, as well as Kubrick's own body of work.
join my beloved corps?
Sir, to kill, sir!
So you're a killer?
Sir, yes, sir!
Let me see your war face.
Sir!
You got a war face? Ah! That's a war face! Now let me see your war face!
Ah!
Bullshit! You didn't convince me! Let me see your real war face!
Ah!
You don't scare me! Work on it!
Sir, yes, sir!
In an attempt to do away with conventional modes of cinematic structure, Kubrick employs a two-act structure in Full Metal Jacket. The first half takes place at a military base in South Carolina, where a band of new recruits are being trained to become the latest wave of efficient killing machines. The film's second half is set in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, one of the defining moments of the war. Kubrick's cast is comprised entirely of unknowns, and is a testament to their talents here that they all went on to respectable acting careers afterwards.
Marine, what is that button on your body armor?
A peace symbol, sir.
Where'd you get it?
I don't remember, sir.
What is that you've got written on your helmet?
Born to kill, sir.
You write born to kill on your helmet and you wear a peace button. What's that supposed to be, some kind of sick joke?
I think I was trying to suggest something about the duality of man, sir.
The what?
The duality of man, the Jungian thing, sir.
Whose side are you on, son?
Matthew Modine headlines the film as the gangly Joker, a mischievous subversive who pairs his military fatigues with a peace symbol decal, which makes his story arc of lost innocence all the more potent. He carries a smug grin on his face throughout the entirety of the film, but you better believe that by film's end, Kubrick will have wiped it right off his face.
What the fuck is that? What is that, Private Pyle?
Sir, a jelly donut, sir!
A jelly donut?
Sir, yes, sir!
How did it get here?
Sir, I took it from the mess hall, sir!
Is chow allowed in the barracks, Private Pyle?
Sir, no, sir!
Are you allowed to eat jelly donuts, Private Pyle?
Sir, no, sir!
And why not, Private Pyle?
Sir, because I'm too heavy, sir!
Because you are a disgusting fat body, Private Pyle!
Sir, yes, sir!
Vincent D'Onofrio makes his film debut in Full Metal Jacket as the fat, uncoordinated Gomer Pyle. He purportedly gained 70 pounds to play the role, offering a hint of those dedicated thespian affectations his career would later be known for.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor. From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
The real star of the show, however, is R. Lee Ermey, who plays the hard-ass drill sergeant Hartman. Prior to the film, Ermey was a real-life retired Marine drill sergeant and was brought onto the project as a tech consultant. His dedication to authenticity was so intense that he outright stole the role of Hartman from the guy who had originally been cast.
How tall are you, Private?
Sir, 5'9", sir!
5'9"? I didn't know they stacked shit that high. You trying to squeeze an inch in on me somewhere, huh?
Sir, no, sir!
Bullshit, it looks to me like the best part of you ran down to crack your mama's ass and ended up as a brown stain on the mattress!
His relentless abuse and creative grasp on insulting profanity approaches the level of performance art, and his particular showing in Full Metal Jacket kickstarted a second career as an in-demand character actor that continues to this day.
You had best unfuck yourself, or I will unscrew your head and check down your neck!
By this point in his career, Kubrick had built up a strong working relationship with cinematographer John Alcott, who shot his previous three features. When Kubrick began to assemble his crew for Full Metal Jacket, Alcott declined a fourth go-round with the Maverick auteur. In hindsight, this would prove to be a serendipitous move for both parties, considering Alcott died during the middle of production. Douglas Milsom, who had previously worked on Kubrick's films as a focus puller, stepped up to assume the role instead. Milsom and Kubrick craft a relatively straightforward visual presentation that's high on style, but low on flash. Kubrick's compositions retain his signature one-point perspectives, which emphasize depth and symmetry, while his camera work builds on The Shining's innovations with the Steadicam by incorporating it as often as possible. Kubrick has always favored extended tracking shots as a way to convey mood, and the rise of the Steadicam allowed him much greater flexibility and versatility in that regard. No longer bound by dolly tracks, he could mount the camera on a Steadicam rig and follow his subjects right into the maelstrom without so much of a hint of handheld jitter. Like Barry Lyndon or The Shining before it, Kubrick counters the formalism of his camera work with new wave techniques like slow zooms and flash cuts. Full Metal Jacket's naturalistic aesthetic isn't as lurid or evocative of other Vietnam classics like Oliver Stone's Platoon or Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, yet Its visuals are just as, if not more, iconic due to Kubrick's legendary eye for composition and considered movement. The music of Full Metal Jacket marks an abrupt departure for Kubrick, who is well known for using prominent classical works to accompany his visuals instead of original scores.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess.
Instead of Baroque concertos, Kubrick opts for the iconic sound of the Vietnam War, rock and roll.
Goodbye, my darling, hello, Vietnam. I'm here to take a battle to be won.
Beginning with Johnny Wright's crooning country ballad, Hello, Vietnam, Kubrick uses an inspired selection of late 70s-era rock music to reflect the dark, subversive, and unpredictable nature of Vietnam's combatants.
I see a Richter and I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black.
A particular standout is the use of the Rolling Stones' Painted Black over the end credits, a musical echo of the darkness that Joker now dwells in after the completion of his character arc. Despite the heavy presence of rock cues, Kubrick does make potent use of an original score written by his daughter, Vivian Kubrick, credited here as Abigail Mead.
Hi, Joker.
Vivian creates a suitably foreboding, industrial sound using electronic instruments that appropriately reflect Kubrick's pitch-black portrait of institutionalized destruction. While Kubrick's films defy easy explanation, they can be distilled into the examination of two primal opposing forces, violence and sex. His last two films, Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut, would become companion pieces in that they each dealt with their respective theme. Violence for the former, sex for the latter. Kubrick was no stranger to war films, but whereas Paths of Glory dealt with the ethical conundrums of warfare on a collective scale, Full Metal Jacket is more concerned with the psychological consequences of warfare on the level of the individual. The film focuses on the military as an institution, not only capable of perpetrating man's inhumanity towards his fellow man, but one that needs such devastation in order to thrive.
Ah, get some, baby! Get some, come on! Get it, come on! Get some, yeah!
Kubrick doesn't depict the military so much as an institution, but as a machine, devouring countless scores of boys whole and spitting them out the other end as robotic killing machines devoid of compassion and empathy. The machine is kept fed by a surrounding culture that commodifies and glorifies violence. Joker's iconic line,
"I wanted to be the first kid on my block to get a confirmed kill,"
is terrifying precisely because it hits so close to home. By film's end, we are left only with one question. What is the cost of warfare? Kubrick's thesis posits that the answer lies not in the form of dollars, but in our very souls. Vietnam was more than just a war for the American public. It was an existential crisis that introduced the idea of cynicism and irony into warfare. It was, for lack of a better term, the hipster war. Having peppered it throughout his filmography to extremely potent effect, Kubrick was no stranger to the concept of irony, and Full Metal Jacket is stuffed to the brim with it. The big bad sniper of the film's climax is revealed to be a scared 12-year-old girl. Soldiers march against fiery scenes of devastation, while cheerily singing the Mickey Mouse Club theme song.
Yes.
A young recruit is trained into such an effective killing machine that he turns his rifle on the man who created him. Full Metal Jacket came out the same year that Oliver Stone's Platoon did, and while Kubrick's final statement on war and violence would eventually lose out the Best Picture Oscar to Stone's breakout film, it now overshadows its formal rival due to the legacy of its genius creator. It may not be the definitive Vietnam film, but it is certainly one of the most definitive films of the war genre. For Kubrick himself, Full Metal Jacket serves as a fitting, yet haunting conclusion to a topic that he spent a lifetime exploring.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net.
The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.